You have to cultivate fearlessness. And the place where fearlessness comes is, on the one hand, a trust in the truth you're fighting for. Put your confidence there, rather than fear of the dominant. Ignore the dominant forces. Think of the rest of which you're a part. Universe, a creative earth, a human community, and draw energy from that. And the second is, as Gandhi said, what's the worst they can do? They can take away your body, they can't take away your spirit.
Welcome to the Campfire Podcast. I am your host, Matthias Olsson. I just had the great privilege of sitting down with legendary activist, teacher, author, doctor of quantum physics, and fearless antagonist of multinationals like Monsanto and others, Dr. Vandana Shiva. Before we continue, I want to mention that the Campfire Podcast is brought to you by the film platform Campfire Stories. It is your boutique-sized Netflix for films to inspire change, to whisper in your ear of the possibility of a different outcome, a different approach. Check it out at campfire-stories.org. I also want to take this opportunity to thank all of our Patreon supporters. Without you, this operation simply would not be possible. If you want to learn more and maybe become a Patreon supporter yourself, please check out patreon.com/Matthias Olsson. That's patreon.com/MATTIASOLSSON. As a member, you'll get inside perks like early access to new films and podcast episodes and your name in the credits. Even $1 or $2 per month makes a huge difference, as per the quantum model that Dr. Shiva will get into here a little bit later. So, patreon.com/Matthias Olsson. Thank you. Also, briefly, before we get on with today's program, I want to send my gratitude to YIP, which is short for the Youth Initiative Program, for facilitating my meeting with Dr. Shiva. YIP is an educational program that strengthens young people's capacity to take initiative in the face of current global challenges. You can read more about it at yip.se. That's yip.se. Today's episode is about activism, and I feel we can all learn from Dr. Shiva about being activists, becoming activists, developing our fearlessness, practicing nonviolence, taking a stand for Mother Earth in different ways. Saying no to yet another development, saying no to yet another highway, to yet another clear cut, practicing our right of free speech and democracy, and saying yes to life, to small-scale organic farming, to healthy food, to coming together as a community. And I can think of no one better to give a masterclass on this topic than Earth Protector, leader and inspirer, Dr. Vandana Shiva. Enjoy the show. I'm so thrilled to be here with you.
Thank you.
This room. Did you just arrive to Sweden just now?
Literally an hour ago.
Oh my God. Okay. So how has Sweden treated you for this brief stay that you've had so far?
No problem.
No problem. Okay. And you're here to teach at YIP.
Yeah, that'll be YIP.
Yeah, wonderful. I might show up tomorrow and with the camera, but I'll try to be just like a fly on the wall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Wonderful. All right. So I know that your work lately has been focused on GMOs, fake food, and seed saving. And we're going to get to all of that pretty soon. But I wanted to start in the forest. We have
a tremendous problem here in Sweden with the clear-cutting practices of the forestry industry that is so fixated on short-sighted profits that they completely neglect to understand the real price tag, which includes a painful uglification of the landscape, a devastating loss of biodiversity, and huge amounts of carbon dioxide being released from the scarred ground. And the new monoculture plantations coming up all turn out highly vulnerable to forest fires, insect attacks, and storm fellings. And most people in this country don't even know this is going on, because the forestry industry are using quite a bit of their earnings towards like running these glossy ads that portray them as like green heroes or something like that. And I feel like we've lost the knack for organizing ourselves and protesting. Like, I know we had it in the 60s and the 70s, but today it just seems harder to mobilize for some reason. And maybe what we need is a story of encouragement. I know you were part of something called the Chipko movement in India, that which stood up to British and other logging companies' plans for turning forests into money. Could you tell me a little bit about the Chipko movement and what they were able to achieve?
The Chipko was the beginning of my ecological activism. I'd gone to trek in one of my favorite forests before leaving for Canada for my PhD. And that forest was gone. It was an oak forest from where lovely streams used to flow. Streams were a trickle, forest gone. And on my way back, waiting for a bus, I talked about how personally painful this was for me. Like, part of my limbs had been cut. And the tea store owner on the roadside said, but now there's hope, there's Chipko. I was leaving for Canada, so I couldn't travel that time, but I took a pledge that every vacation of mine would be spent as a volunteer for Chipko. So what was the Chipko movement? Chipko means to hug, to embrace. And as the deforestation was increasing, in the Himalaya, disasters were increasing. Landslides, flooding, an entire river, Alaknanda, was devastated. And that's when the women said, the loggers must stop. And they started to blockade. Yeah? One woman would blockade. Then they got more organized. And the whole idea was, we will not let you cut these trees, because they gave us food and soil and water. And we're going to embrace them if you try and cut them. You'll have to kill us before you kill the trees. And this went on from the early 70s till 81, when we actually got a logging ban in the High Himalaya. Because there was a huge disaster, the entire Ganges was blocked by a landslide. And then there was a flood. So I always say, you know, I went to the University of Western Ontario to do a PhD in quantum theory, but I did my ecology PhD with the Chipko movement. And I think the power of the Chipko movement was they created the real ecological paradigm. So you think these are just timber mines? For you, they're just profits. For you, they're dead. For us, they're our mothers. They give us life. And part of it was, this was India's culture. And I'm so happy that on the Mother Earth Day, which is 22nd of April this year, I'm going to visit a site where in 1930, when Gandhi had walked to the beach to make salt, because the British had made salt making illegal for the Indians to collect profits and revenue, he walked to the beach, picked up the salt and said, nature gives it for free. We need it for our survival. We will continue to make salt. We will not obey your laws. That was the big satyagraha, the force of truth. And at the time when 1930, they were doing these protests along the coast, in the mountains, without internet, without anything, people were doing a forest satyagraha. We will not let you cut these forests. We will not let you enclose our commons. So the story of Chipko is not just important for understanding the power of nonviolent action, but also realizing how deep the knowledge of the people who live in the ecosystem is. Mm. And Chipko took place before the Stockholm Environmental Summit in 1972.
Mm. So they were the original, because you hear tree hugging.
That's the original.
So that's the original.
Yeah.
So we need to get back to some serious tree hugging.
We do need to. And, you know, for me, that became the guide to action, that you can face those who are destroying and keep asking them and they will not listen. You know? Or you can turn to what you love and turn your backs to power and join the forces of nature and the forces of organized people.
Hmm.
That, to me, is the power of any real action to protect the earth and protect people's rights. And the two go together.
Yeah.
And by the way,
yes,
I've grown up in the Himalayan forest because my father was a forest conservator. So forests are very, very close to me.
This is what I didn't know about you. When I started doing research for this, I was listening to, is it called Terra Viva?
In
one of your books.
Yeah.
And you were talking about chipka. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, I thought it was all about seeds and GMOs. And
that's later in life. Yeah.
Wonderful. What would you say? So we talked about tree hugging, but just to expand the idea horizon a little bit, what would you say could be some actions or manifestations that a person or a group could take in order to prevent a logging company from clear-cutting a beloved forest? Would you say, for example, that sometimes it might be necessary to break the law, maybe even use sabotage as a method? Or do you think it's important and maybe even more effective to take the moral high road and stick with nonviolence?
Well, I always have stayed with nonviolence for two reasons. It empowers you more. You know, you work on the terms of love. Whereas when you do the physical destruction, you work from anger. And in a system where the dominant powers of the corporations on the one hand and states they have taken over, which I call them corporate states, their power to take away your rights, that's all they exist for.
Mm.
Yeah? So you start to play on their terms.
Mm.
And I believe you have to shift the paradigm of what is the forest. You have to shift the paradigm of what is power. And you have to shift the paradigm in terms of what actions we can take.
Because sometimes I get so angry I want to do something violent. But then, like, I have this one idea that I could never do, but I imagine going to, like, the CEO of a logging company and just going to their home and just clear-cutting their backyard. But then I feel so bad for the apple trees and whatever. So I couldn't do it, but it would be, like, in a way, it's something that appeals to me when I get angry, that type of thinking.
You know, what I have realized is you definitely have to come in the way of destructive action.
Hmm.
How you come in the way is the issue. Do you come in the way so the ground from which you are acting is the higher ground? You shift the terms of discussion and debate. But the other thing is that every point, at least since colonial times, destruction of nature, of the land, of the rivers, of the oceans, of forests, has constantly been justified in different forms of the civilizing mission.
Mm.
That you're primitive, we have something better to offer you, and we'll destroy you to civilize you. What's the justification for clear cutting? More productive, more revenues, more earnings. And in today's time, it is even worse, because I know definitely for this part of what, even in America and Canada, they're destroying forests to then create electricity and calling it green technology. The tree is the green technology.
Right. Or creating a biofuel, so-called biofuel.
But this is biofuel. Yeah. This is biofuel.
Yeah.
You know? And added to this is the fact that when you do commercial forestry, for extraction of any kind, for pulp, for timber, for biofuel, you maximize that which you can extract. That means you create monocultures. To create monocultures, you must take forests which are diverse with different species and glyphosate them to death. You must use Roundup. Now, Roundup kills everything green. In particular, right now, it's killing all the herbaceous plants and the evergreen plants, which are the real place where the forest is formed. The humus is formed there. The soil is regenerated there because this cycling of organic matter to form the humus, that's the real cycle of life. And it merges as a hydrological cycle and an nutritional cycle. And here you're taking the most creative part of nature's expressions of diversity and turning them into dead monocultures, which are with a poison. And that's why wildfires are not just increasing because your temperature went up average across the globe 1 degree or 1.5. They're going up because you're using so much monoculture, so much glyphosate. And these are really, you know, these are plantations, and plantations are not forests. Forest is the place of diversity, you know. One of our very famous poets who got the Nobel Prize, Rabindranath Tagore, had said, India is a forest civilization. And we are what we are because we learned from the forest. Our learned people went off to the forest, and that's where the Vedas and the Upanishads were written, in communion with the forest. And even more importantly, he says, it's from the forest we learn diversity. It's from the forest we realize that a society must have diversity of every kind. And that is where democracy is born. We learn democracy from the forest. The monoculture teaches us intolerance.
Right. That's beautiful. And I feel like we are a nation of forests. In Sweden as well, in a different way perhaps. But and now you go and you can barely find old growth forests anymore. All right, I'd like to turn to GMOs, which is short for genetically modified organisms. And just first off, just to be clear on exactly what we're talking about, in your view, are GMOs always bad? Meaning, if the goal of the modification is, for example, to have potatoes that can withstand some disease, or if you want to have seedless watermelons, let's say, is that the same, like, should that be put in the same category as the patent on life agrochemical varieties?
Well, GMOs are designed for patents. And I say this from my having participated in a meeting in 1987, organized by the Dag Hammarskjöld Foundation, which is a foundation in Sweden, which most people don't know anymore. But it was founded on the work of Dag Hammarskjöld, who was the first Secretary General of the United Nations. And it has played an extremely important role. And just in the 80s, late 80s, when the tools of splicing genes and moving them across species through techniques of recombinant DNA, you know, they were starting to be looked at by the companies. The scientists who'd done the work said, we will call a moratorium. We don't know. We know how to do it, but we don't know what it does. Therefore, we will study deeper and call a moratorium on our research. Forget the commercialization. And then the companies picked it up. So at this meeting organized by the Dag Hammarskjöld Foundation in partnership with the United Nations, which is called Laws of Life, it was inquiring what will be the implications of genetic engineering and biotechnology. And at this meeting, the chemical companies stated it so clearly. They said, we're not making enough profits from chemicals, now we must own the seed. And to own the seed, we must take patents. To get a patent, we must modify the organism to claim we've done something new. GMOs are the path to patenting. And they went on to say, we'll be five companies by the turn of the century, which is 24 years ago, controlling all food and all health. And to reach there, we have to use at that point, the GATT, which became the World Trade Organization, to make a law to forbid farmers to save seeds by defining seed as intellectual property, as something invented by the corporations. So for me, from the beginning, the story of GMOs is the story of patents. They are inseparable. And actually, GMO should be interpreted as God move over. We are the creators.
As what? As
God move over. GMO.
Yeah.
Because what are the corporations claiming when they claim a patent? They're claiming invention.
Right.
And they're claiming a monopoly through invention. But a seed is not an invention. And therefore, they're positioning themselves as the God, as the creators.
Right.
And then wanting to have a monopoly. So we should always begin with the issue of patents and then reach to what are these organisms doing, because still the civilizing mission, that they do things that you can't by other means, which is also false for two reasons. It's false because you want to prepare drought-tolerant breed. Farmers have done it for millennia. We have drought-tolerant seeds. We have flood-tolerant seeds. We have pest-resistant seeds. We have all this in diversity. Now, corporations cannot create a trait. They can take it. They can take a seed from a farmer and they can add a trait. Not create it. They cannot create. But because all beneficial traits are a concert of all the genes working in harmony. They are what are called multigenetic traits. And you can't engineer multigenetic traits, just like you can't engineer a mixed forest.
Right.
So what you do is actually pick up toxic traits and add them. So for the first 30 years, what did they bring? I mean, initially, because I used to do a lot of the debates with industry at that time, I was part of writing the United Nations Biosafety Protocol on the impact of GMOs. I was part of working with the European Parliament on the US laws. And there was a very good Swedish negotiator from Foreign Ministry, Ulf Svensson, who played a very big role in these treaties. The argument is we will grow food on the moon, we will grow food on toxic dumps, because this technology is all-powerful. 30 years later, what did we have? Two traits. Herbicide resistance, the plant can now tolerate more glyphosate and everything else will be killed, as they said in the negotiations. It kills everything green. Now, anything that kills everything green is engaging in ecocidal acts. And the other trait was Bt toxin, where you put a toxin into the plant. Now, this was the GMO introduced illegally by Monsanto in India in 1998, because I'd been part of writing the international laws, I'd been part of writing the Indian laws. I immediately checked out, and they'd taken no permission. So I sued them. And that's why they got absolutely angry, because they were all powerful. But I worked according to the law. And since that time, we have been doing studies, monitoring. We've lost 400,000 farmers to suicide because of debt. Of these suicides, 85% are in the cotton area. 95% of the cotton is now Monsanto's Bt cotton. So that's straight a social ecological impact. We've done studies on pollinators. No pollinator on a Bt toxin plant. They get killed. We've done studies on soil organisms. In the first 10 years of planting of Bt cotton, 60% beneficial organisms have disappeared. Because it's toxic in every leaf, in every grain of pollen, in the roots, everywhere. And this is how assessments should be done, not through the rhetoric and propaganda that, oh, we now have a technology which will not need pesticides. They are using more pesticides than before. I remember in 2017, 100, and 35 farmers died because of pesticide poisoning, because the BT could not control the pests. So farmers were using more spray and they were dying of poisoning.
Mm.
Yeah?
And the crops, and, I would imagine, aren't very healthy.
No, and the slogan was, you will never need to spray.
Mm.
But you're having to spray more. So, and research has now been done, you know. Mothers eat food with BT crops. It's in the blood of their fetuses.
Right.
Yeah. So we just, all I say is, I don't say decide from before. I say study.
Right.
Assess. And recently, European Parliament has sadly removed regulation.
Right.
Of the GMOs, which are made to look like they're new kind. But they still use the old technologies. They still use foreign genes. They still use the agrobacterium to shoot a vector. But, you know, it's all... Sadly, science has been replaced by propaganda. You know, whatever. And European citizens have been robbed of their right to safety.
And Monsanto and other GMO companies will claim that their methods of industrialized farming will feed a growing population and that small-scale and organic farmers simply won't get that job done. What would you say to that?
Well, unfortunately, I've had to spend the last 40 years of my life addressing this question. As I mentioned, my background is physics. I did a PhD in quantum theory. I did ecology in the broad, on the rivers, on the forests. 84... The land where I had done my MSc honours in particle physics erupted in huge violence, the land of Punjab. 15,000 people were killed. Military was sent to the Golden Temple. And I had to ask myself two questions. Firstly, what happened between the time, 73, I graduated, and the early 80s? I said, in this 10 years, what happened?
Hmm.
And the second was, Mr. Borlaug got a Nobel Peace Prize for introducing the Green Revolution to Punjab. And why is there bloodshed? So the narratives weren't falling into place. And as a scientist, I must make sense of what I see. I was working for the United Nations University for a program on conflicts over resources at that time. And I said, something strange is going on here. Can you let me study? And they let me, and I did a book called The Violence of the Green Revolution. And that book then became the basis of not just, it was the first ecological study on the impact of industrial agriculture, which is called Green Revolution when it's introduced in the South. Not very green, and it's definitely not revolutionary.
It sounds, it has a nice ring to it.
Of course, of course. So, first, only industrial farming can feed the world. The reason it's not true is A, hunger has become permanent with the industrialization of food. Earlier it came, a small hunger epidemic or famine came because there was a drought or there was a war. But now it's in the structure of the system because they're not growing food, they're growing commodities.
Hmm.
And they're growing it very high cost. And they're growing it in ways that's destroying the very basis of farming. Industrialization makes you think that you're working outside nature. But farming is a biological act. And you have to work with the seed. It might be modified, but the origins is a living seed. You have to work with the soil. You might deny that the soil is living. You might call it an empty container, but it's what gives you the food. Biodiversity is what you work with.
Hmm.
So the denial of nature and the arrogance of you as the producer makes you blind to not just the power of the living soil, the power of healthy seed, power of good farmers. Most importantly, it makes you blind to the harm you're causing, to this real productive base. 75% of the soil destroyed in these few decades of industrial farming. 75% of the water polluted and destroyed. 90% of the biodiversity, which is the key to both life on Earth and farming. 50% of the greenhouse gases come from an industrial food system. I wrote a book on this called Soil Not Oil, and now I'm writing another book on updating it with the new industrialization attempt through fake food.
Right.
Yeah. So, industrial food systems are not feeding the world. They're causing destruction of the planet and they're causing disease. 75% of the chronic diseases, which has become an epidemic, comes from the industrial food system, production with the chemicals and the processing, the ultra-processed food. Second, small farms produce more. The data is there. Because small farms have what large farms cannot offer, the element of love and care. And in living systems, that is what matters. If your plants have to be taken care of, they must get attention. Spraying glyphosate doesn't do that work. Large part of my work was to show that the measure of yield per acre, which is what they use to say we feed the world, is a misleading measure. Because all it measures is weight or what leaves the farm. It does not measure the state of the farm. It does not measure the state of biodiversity. It does not measure the state of the farmer. Why are the farmers on the street everywhere? In India, across Europe. Because it's being made impossible for them to live in an industrial system. And even more importantly, it doesn't measure the quality of the food you're eating. So I said, this is a wrong indicator. It's measuring only the flows of commodities. It's not measuring food.
Right.
So I said, I'm going to measure nutrition and food per acre because food is to be eaten to nourish us. And our work in Navdanya, the movement I started, shows that we could feed two times India's population, two times the world population, by getting rid of the chemicals, intensifying biodiversity, intensifying love and care. We do this. And then we measure it. So small farms is where love and care can be. Small farms feed the world. Women feed the world. Biodiverse farms feed the world. And because this blind spot is making you look only at the commodity flow, it's not looking at what food are the people eating.
Right.
80% food that's being eaten today comes from small farms. That's UN data.
I love it. Intensify the love and care. Wonderful. So I want to talk about biodynamics a little bit, biodynamic farming. So I happen to live in an area here where biodynamic farming is normal or common. And whenever I hear of other places in the world where there's biodynamic farming, India always comes up as an example for me that I've heard. And I actually made a film once about the esoteric aspects of biodynamic farming. And some of those concepts were a little bit difficult for me to understand fully. But I was curious, but I couldn't really understand everything. But I'm just curious, what's your personal take on biodynamic farming?
Well, I've actually just written a foreword to Steiner's Agriculture Lectures for a French edition. They're publishing of the lectures and they wrote to me. A lot of importance is given to the esoteric part of it. Not enough attention is paid to the fact that Steiner is constantly talking about respecting nature and recognizing what nature does, which is basically the living systems. Because, mechanistic reductionism has moved us from the paradigm of terra madre, the living earth, to terra nullius, the empty earth. And the biodynamic principles are basically saying, look at the soil. Look at the life in the soil. Relate to it, enrich it at the living system. Now, that which has been called esoteric, that was the language he used. For me, it is exactly the new things that we learn from the quantum world. In the quantum world, there are no material entities that can be caught and measured. What's there is the potential. And when you measure it, then that potential gets expressed as a wave or a particle. But the basic is not the wave or the particle, because in the inert world, you couldn't be both. But in the world of potential, you can have the potential for both.
Hmm.
So I think in the age when Steiner was, there was still this big division, you know, between the subtle energies of the material, physical world and the spiritual aspects. But I think as consciousness is growing, we realize that, you know, in Ayurveda, we talk about subtle energies. You can't measure it. But they are what give the healing power.
Hmm.
So I think the moment is ripe for us to take the best of learning from the quantum worldview, the best of learning from diverse systems of farming, healing, that are not reductionist and mechanistic,
hmm.
but understand flows and relationships and energies. Because that's what's missing in the Cartesian mechanical world. And the other thing we really need to do is understand the principles and concepts and not get stuck with the vocabulary. Because vocabulary can get outdated, and particularly for the biodynamic. I have watched, you know, when the biotech industry couldn't stand the fact that I was doing the science of biosafety. I was doing the assessments of what is it doing in the field.
Mm.
Their excuse was, oh, Vandana, she was not scientific. You know, she's not. And then they changed my degrees in Wikipedia page. They removed my physics. But the attack on biodynamic has been exactly the same. When the mechanistic thinking people accuse the non-mechanistic ecological paradigm of being unscientific, it doesn't make the ecological paradigm unscientific.
Right.
They are just like yield is the wrong measure of productivity in agriculture. Mechanistic philosophy is the wrong measure for a living world.
I love that. Thank you. Yeah, because in that film, I was also, because that it started out with somebody was really angry with biodynamics, mm-hmm. saying that, oh, it's dangerous, it's like crazy people doing unscientific things. And so I came into it thinking, what's here that could possibly be make this man so upset? Like, I was trying to figure it out. And then I understood, like, why. But I'm like, well, if you're going to be upset about things in the world that are wrong, this should be pretty far down the list to me. Like, yeah. I think there's other things that you could... Yeah.
But I think it's this fundamentalism that has been cultivated.
Yeah.
That anything that is not mechanical reductionist thought
right.
is dangerous.
Yeah.
For them it's dangerous. Because mechanical thought was created for an empire of man over the world. Yeah, the Bacon said it, the Boyle said it, they said it very clearly. We've got to establish this philosophy in order to establish power.
Mm.
So if they find anything that is free, anything that is alive, anything that is open, they find it just dangerous.
Yeah.
And so if you've internalized the mechanical philosophy too deeply, you have that reaction.
Mm. Well, thank you so much. All right, here's something that is really at the core of this whole talk, I think, to me. Over the last few generations, the global rate of depression, especially among young people, is rising exponentially. It seems to me that this could have something to do with the fact that in our globalized and specialized world, we feel increasingly disconnected from the anonymous production chain that now provides us with things like song, dance, stories, food, water, and warmth. But do you think there could also be a link between rising rates of depression and soil health? That what we eat actually might make us depressed?
Well, of course, there are multiple causes to the fact that the epidemic of depression is just exploding. We know glyphosate causes depression. Studies have been done. We know the soil health is connected to the gut health. We now know in the last 10 years that the gut health is connected to the brain health. And so many of the enzymes and so many of the chemicals that a healthy diet produces maintain a healthy brain. New research is showing that even down to Alzheimer's and those neurodegenerative diseases, they're connected to the fact that our gut microbiome is being severely assaulted with chemicals on the one hand, nutritionally empty food on the other, and monoculture diets, because 100 trillion microbes in our gut need a diversity of diet, and they can sense it when they don't get it. For them, it's starvation. And when some microbes, which are produced performing a certain function, die for lack of the right food, then your brain starts to get harmed. So it has material connections. But it also has the fact that society is rushing into destruction of community and relationships. After all, what was industrialization? Industrialization was break community, turn people who ran society together into workers in a factory. Break them up. Now, with the new digital technologies, it's even worse. Because the only friend you have is the fake friend that Zuckerberg has created, you know, in Facebook. So not only are they not there to support you, worse, they're creating a strange kind of feeling. I know of children in India who've committed suicide because their friendship rates went down. I've watched new clinics come up where young people are getting surgeries done to have their Facebook photo done with a perfect nose. So the alienation, isolation, which it's leading to, is also an added reason for depression. The Surgeon General of America has just produced a report saying this whole tech-driven society is leading to isolation, which is then leading to depression. Because you need community. To be who you are, you need the other. To be human, if we define by the soil, the word human comes from humus, the soil. And these alienations and tearing aparts are adding up materially, psychologically, socially.
You've mentioned a few times the term fake food. I was wondering if you could just elaborate a little bit on what you mean when you say fake food and why that's important to distinguish from real food.
So, you know, real food is processed by the soil. It's processed by the plant. It is processed on small scale by loving, caring people, mothers, grandmothers. That's real food. It has to go through these systems that reinforce the living. Fake food is an attempt to engineer that which is complex, that which is self-organized, that which is living. Chemical industrial agriculture faked the nutrition of the soil. Synthetic fertilizer were a pretend nutrition of the soil. They kill the soil. They destroy the water. They give us greenhouse gases. They are not producing soil fertility. Again, another false narrative. The soil is dying. The organisms are dying. We've done so many studies comparing the chemical soils and the organic soils. Organisms, minerals just shoot up in the organic soils with care. And they're disappearing in the artificially fertilized soil. You include, take nitrogen, which is the most dominant synthetic fertilizer. Farms that have applied synthetic nitrogen fertilizer have lost their nitrogen 22% in the 20 years. Meantime, organic soils where we applied nothing external have gained nitrogen 100%. So we've been just, that mechanistic narrative has just told lies and we believed it. So the first element of distortion was you fake the nourishment of the soil and you produce nutritionally empty food. And there's enough research, 70 to 80% nutrition gone. Then, and besides nutritionally empty, it's toxic. So you're eating food loaded with chemicals. Cancer, 5% are genetic, 95% are environmental. So many cancers are coming from the pesticides we're using. They've identified as carcinogen. WHO identified glyphosate as a carcinogen. Next level of going away from real food was the ultra-processing of food. You know, I make a pickle with real ingredients. It has even more nourishing values than the vegetables I used for it. But when I do ultra-processing, I begin to use artificial elements. I start to use high fructose corn syrup. I start to use chemically assembled material. And that's caused the chronic disease epidemic we are seeing right now. And now, the brilliant people like Mr. Gates, looking for new ways to profit and patent, are pushing for lab food with the slogan, farming without farmers. Hmm. And that's the digital agriculture they're talking about.
As if that's supposed to be a good thing.
Yeah. And food without farms.
Hmm.
So what does that mean? Does that mean that destructive industrial agriculture will disappear? No. It'll increase in scale with increase in chemicals.
Hmm.
And the companies like Bayer, which bought Monsanto, are saying so clearly, this is such an opportunity for us. Because this lab food, which also parades under the, very often under the name plant-based, everything is plant-based. You can't have life without plant-based. Even the cow eats plants, you know?
Yeah.
If you eat products like dairy, they're plant-based in the origin. So you suddenly, out of the blue, you've cooked up this thing, plant-based. This plant-based is such an opportunity for us because now we will produce, they're not saying food, we will now produce raw materials for the labs. Because even if you're working with cells and microbes, they too need food. And new research is showing they'll need 5 times more land, very resource and energy intensive. All this being done in the name of climate change, they will have 25 times more emissions.
Hmm.
Because emissions come from energy intensive processes. So fake food at this point is things like Impossible Burger, which has 14 patents associated with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's done for, you know, owning
yeah.
our food itself, the bread of life itself. But just like ultra-processed food has caused so much harm, what will ultra, ultra, ultra-processed food do?
Yeah.
They're not looking at health. They've just created this fiction or solution to climate. So fake is fake. I mean, it doesn't need too much explanation. What's right. fake? Yeah. That's what's not real.
Yeah, but then it's easy to get caught up and think that, oh, I have to have a vegetarian or vegan diet in order to help Mother Earth. And you turn to plant-based, like soy burgers and so forth. And yeah, so you have to be careful.
But it already has.
Yeah.
In fact, the more conscious, but the non-thinking.
Yeah.
You know, more conscious for environmental issues, but not seeing the relationships.
Right.
Hmm. You talk to anyone, they're all vegan.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Because they don't understand food.
So we have to be careful. If something sounds good, like green revolution sounds great, maybe we have to be extra careful when it sounds really good, like these labels.
Yeah. I mean, go by two things. Go by experience. If societies have lived well with good food for thousands of years,
yeah.
And food has been something that every society has grown and eaten.
Mm.
You know, don't assume that you're the first smart human being in the planet.
Huh? That's a good one.
Turn and see. You know, what is the role of food in the earth? What's the role of food in history?
Mm.
You know, understand all that.
Mm.
And definitely distinguish between the propaganda of big interests. And don't turn it into your thought thinking.
Right.
Yeah. Krishnamurti, very famous philosopher from India. In fact, they wanted him to be a incarnation and he walked away from it. He has said intelligence is distinguishing between the false and the true. So maintaining intelligence to have the capacity to distinguish between the false and the true.
And stand up for it once you've realized it, because there can be pressures and well, that's something that you know everything about. So your lifelong activism has routinely disrupted all these powerful international corporations, be it in the field of logging, limestone extraction, neem oil patents, GMOs, etc. And this has made you a target. And I know you've been both subjected to systematic ridicule and threats over the years. And as you said, they removed something from your Wikipedia. Can they even do that? How did they do that?
No, because Wikipedia is constructed by anyone who wants to add anything.
But earlier we were talking about protesting against forests that were being clear cut. And so let's say there's someone out there listening to this who's contemplating taking part in a manifestation to protect a forest. What would you say to them in regard to potential personal risks of threat, ridicule, or even incarceration?
Well, from what I have learned over all these many years, is you have to cultivate fearlessness. A lot of young people taking climate change seriously, which one should, are getting into despair. But you can take it seriously and make it the reason for more action. Yeah? And the reason for finding alternatives. So the risks are there, but the risks should not be reason for you either to be scared or to become inactive. And the place where fearlessness comes is, on the one hand, a trust in the truth you're fighting for. Put your confidence there, rather than fear of the dominant.
Mm.
Ignore the dominant forces. Think of the rest of which you're a part. A universe, a creative earth, a human community. And draw energy from that. And the second is, as Gandhi said, what's the worst they can do? Yeah. They can take away your body, they can't take away your spirit.
Mm. Wow. I just love that. And you said fearlessness is something you grow into? Was that?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think this mechanistic worldview has made us think that everything is ready-made, inert, buy it off the supermarket shelf.
Yeah.
All qualities in the world are potentials that grow.
Mm.
And human qualities are potentials that human beings grow. So hope is a potential you cultivate.
Mm.
Or you can cultivate despair. Love is a potential you create, or you can create hate. Fearlessness is a potential you create, or you can cultivate fear. It's all about gardening.
And quantum mechanism.
Yeah, and quantum, yeah.
Put those two together, that's pretty powerful stuff.
Mm.
Wonderful. When I think about how I can be the change I'd like to see in the world, it gets a little bit depressing when I look at what I do and then compare that to someone like Rosa Parks or Mahatma Gandhi or you, for that matter. So I try to think in terms of direction instead of goal-orientedness. Because if the goal is to live my life in such a way that the imprint I make is a regenerative one, all the steps I need to take to get there just seem impossible. But as soon as I look at just taking one step, the next step, it doesn't seem so impossible anymore. It almost seems like fun all of a sudden. And suddenly a variety of possible next steps become available to me. So for anybody out there who might feel overwhelmed by the thought of, quote, saving the planet, do you think it's enough to just do one thing, to just do the next thing? Is it enough, let's say, to switch to organic milk tomorrow? Or start growing your own lettuce in the spring, or leave the car in the lot and start biking to work, or whatever might be the next step of of somebody. So just one step instead of the weight of all the steps.
So the first thing is, in an interconnected and living world, even one step has multiple ramifications. That's what the quantum idea of non-locality is. We live in an entangled world. Your end of it is the one step. But the one step then sends reverberations throughout. And the second thing is, a lot of people feel overwhelmed because that Cartesian, mechanical, anthropocentric worldview has been seeped into us over centuries. And it's been made the natural way of our thinking. But it's a very artificial way that's been imposed on us. And it has then led to people start to think, I'm an atlas carrying the world on my shoulders. No, we're just one among trillions of species. Our capacity is a small bit. We are not atlases. And we are not carrying the earth is carrying us. The minute you shift from that anthropocentric arrogance to a humility of being a member of the earth family, just like every day within your family, you don't think of the 5,000 things that need to be done collectively. You think of your duty of that day. If your duty that day was dishwashing, wash the dishes well. If your duty was to drop the children to school, do that well. And between the interconnectedness of the world and the fact that there is diversity in the world means that your one step is multiple steps taken by others because you're facilitating. And the paradigm of humility says, my one step is going to be in service to the earth. My one step will be in service to community. And you shift from all-powerful, all-achieving, isolated individual to an interconnected part of a web of life, knowing that you're a small part and your capacity is a small step. But the web of life is great. And to play the right role in that web of life is the greatness we can be part of.
Thank you. Sometimes I also think about time, that we always seem to want to measure what we did the next day. But I don't know how I interact with my daughter today will affect her in 30 years. So that's another way that I try to get out of the I have to save the world today kind of thinking.
Back again to the quantum worldview.
Yeah.
Uncertainty. The world is not a predictable machine. You're not operating a machine. You're living in a conscious world that is complex and uncertain. The uncertainty of the outcome does not translate into uncertainty about what's the right thing to do.
Thank you. Beautiful. All right. So it's time to imagine a different kind of tomorrow to close out this conversation. And a lot of people, including myself sometimes, imagine a transitioned, regenerative world as something to be achieved through letting go of a lot of the current privileges, whether it be flying to another part of the world for a vacation or the convenient use of plastic throwaway containers, or as I did this morning, eating a delicious avocado here in Sweden that was flown in from someplace else in the world. It's easy to imagine that to get to a better world, we need to sacrifice things that maybe we don't really want to sacrifice. It's much harder to imagine what we actually might gain after we've let go of such privileges. It seems to me like we're a bunch of addicts who have a hard time imagining a sober life being much of a life at all. But maybe you can help me paint a picture of how you see the future once we've turned the page and started building a healthy regenerative culture for humans and for the rest of life.
You know, every time, whether it's those who push extraction or those who want to shift, everyone thinks from the perspective of being consumers. Your privileges are seen as being consumers of things. And therefore, imagining the future that works better for you, works better for the earth, works better for society, means shifting from consumption to living. Living the good life. Living for happiness of yourself and all others. Now, there is no way. Living in ways that you take less, you share more, is a sacrifice. It actually helps you grow and leaves more space for everyone else. Even more importantly, not only is it about consumption alone, and we forget that we are creative beings. The reason the power of eating and growing organic is so revolutionary is it allows us to do what needs to be done, to remember we can co-create with the living earth. I'm wearing a hand-knitted cardigan made by some women in our community. Just to not forget how to knit. And to imagine that you have to go to H&M to buy the next clothing.
Right.
You know? That is the enlargement we need. To shift from being consumers to being producers, but producers as earth citizens with all the limits it creates in order for the system to keep thriving. And then you realize that limit is not a restriction. The limit is the conscious boundary through which you live to create more well-being, including for yourself. The young kids who are being made to believe that clothing is to be thrown away after one use can never be satisfied because they have to look for the next brand, the next shopping, the next party, the next... So satisfaction, being at peace, is probably the highest place of happiness and peace within. And that's not a sacrifice. Dissatisfaction is a sacrifice. To never know when enough is enough. Which means to never know who you are. So in fact, the world, future world, is inviting us to evolve to the best possible earth citizenship rather than the crass, third-rate life of junk food, junk clothing, junk relationships.
Right.
Imagining this is the real.
Thank you. That, what a wonderful image to finish up with. That's the world I want to be a tiny little part in creating. And I know you are a big part in creating that. Thank you so much for sitting down with me. I feel blessed to have had this conversation and this opportunity.
Thank you. My pleasure too.
Thank you for listening. This podcast is made possible by its Patreon supporters. Please allow me to mention a few of them by name. Suki Cannon, September Larsen, Livsring vid Silje Hystad, Lisette Thoft, Camilla Freiberg, Brigitte Reppen, Alice Hall, Peggy Campbell, and Nicole Alger. Thank you. And if you want to learn more about becoming a Patreon supporter, please visit patreon.com/Mattias Olsen. There is a link for that in the show description. I hope you enjoyed this interview. I know that these episodes are released a little bit irregularly, to say the least, which I'm sure can be frustrating as a listener. But on the other hand, I never release anything unless I really mean it, all the way from the depth of my being. With that, it's time to say farewell for now, and until the next time, take care.